Hello and welcome to the Newism podcast, where we talk to social entrepreneurs and big thinkers to discover how they would shape a new, more sustainable and inclusive global system where humans live within the means of the planet and all forms of life can thrive. This week, we're talking to Ken Banks. Ken is the head of social purpose at Yoti, a startup which develops innovative digital identity solutions. He is also an award-winning social entrepreneur and a mobile technology and global development expert. Ken is best known for developing Frontline SMS, a mobile messaging platform which is used by nonprofits in over 190 countries across the world. He has written 2 books on social innovation and is an in-demand speaker, thought leader, and mentor. Mel and Ken's conversation spans many topics, including the urgent need for moral leadership, the responsible use of technology, purpose, and the role of business in creating better societies, and Ken's own journey to becoming a highly respected social entrepreneur. His realistic optimism imbues the entire conversation and will leave listeners with renewed hope for a better future. The current series of the Newism podcast was recorded during lockdown, so we were at the mercy of technology and Wi-Fi connections. Please bear with us if the sound quality isn't quite up to scratch. We promise the content of the conversations is worth it.
Welcome to the latest Newism podcast. Delighted to say that we've got Ken Banks with us today. He's near Cambridge. So Ken, maybe the first question is, tell us a little about your background. You did a lot of work in Africa. Tell us about what you were doing there and what motivated you to do that.
Sure. So I'm originally from Jersey in the Channel Islands. And of course, you know, surrounded by beautiful countryside, lovely environment to be brought up in. The rest of the world isn't like that, of course. It took me a while to realize that. But for the first 25, 30 years of my life, I was pretty happy there, I suppose you could say. Left school, worked in finance, went to Jersey Zoo a lot, did lots of walks, cliff walks on the beaches, and you know, generally quite a happy existence, although I was always thinking that there was something that I should be doing with my life. Didn't quite know what it was and didn't even really know where to find it. Live Aid 85 changed everything. Watched best part of a day of the concert for the Ethiopian famine that Bob Geldof and Midge Ure put on. And, you know, sitting in Jersey in the middle of the summer, seeing that, it's like, oh my goodness, like this, there's a whole world out there which is so very different to the one I'm seeing. And of course, this is pre-internet, pre-social media. You only got to read about the world that newspaper editors or, you know, news agents on TVs were feeding you. So this was something of a shock. So I just completely turned direction in my life, I suppose. I mean, I was working in finance. I'd learned to code when I was very young. So I had a knack for technology, which became very useful later on. So I just started reading, taking a huge interest in development. You know, why is the world so imbalanced? Why is all the money going to the humanitarian sector, not really having the sorts of impact that you would have thought the money would have when you're talking about, you know, billions and billions? And after a while, I just decided I wanted to get out there and see it for myself. So in 1993, I volunteered for a Jersey government trip to Zambia to help build a school. And I left for, it was a 5-week trip, July 1993, and it completely changed me. You know, to be with people who were struggling just to exist, and to be with people who really had nothing. I mean, ironically, they seemed much happier and much more content with what they had than anybody I knew in Jersey, which, you know, still kind of strikes me. But I sort of just realized after that trip that I didn't want to spend my life making other people rich, and there was much more to it than that. So 2 years later, went to Uganda to help build a hospital, and then decided that was it for me. I needed to commit my life to this. So I sold up in 96, went to University of Sussex, studied social anthropology and development studies to try and get a more theoretical understanding of the issues. And as you can probably tell already, I was very much focused on the best way of learning is to read a lot, to travel a lot, to get yourself out there, to immerse yourself in the places where you have an interest rather than just trying to do it totally remotely. While I was at university, I did 3 months in Uganda on a biodiversity survey. I continued working at Jersey Zoo on a few things. And so my kind of love for Africa really wasn't a choice. It just seemed that every opportunity that I was presented happened to be somewhere in Africa. Graduated, I'll fast forward through this, otherwise I will not stop talking for an hour. I graduated, I went straight back to the tech world after that. I went to Cable and Wireless, helped roll out digital TV across the UK. I needed money and I didn't know what else to do. I kind of met a Finnish girl during this time who lived in Finland. I decided I wanted to spend time with her, so I quit Cable and Wireless. I sold everything I owned and I moved to Finland and I taught English there for a year. Then after that, I left Finland and I ended up in Nigeria running a primate sanctuary because, again, I was sort of a bit lost at this point. You can probably tell there's no real career direction here. It's just a purely opportunistic kind of life I was leading. But I had no mortgage, had no wife, had no kids, had no debts. So, you know, and that's one thing I really encourage younger people to try and, you know, avoid doing if they can at the beginning, is to try to have as few ties as possible so that you can react to opportunities. And then after I left Nigeria with a broken leg, after a year running this primate sanctuary, all my tech work really started. But maybe that's another question or another part of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating background and interesting what you're saying about young people, you experiencing life and learning from it. And I guess there's many more opportunities open up. There's different, all sorts of different roads you can take, which you did. Very interested, but before we get onto the technology part, just in a comment you made there when you were in Africa and you said that people were very, very poor, but actually seemed to be happier. That's a common comment that a lot of people make, particularly in the world of development. I just wonder whether we've got our priorities right in the world in terms of material possessions, and that whether actually our happiness index in, say, the UK, where we are, is actually lower than in some other countries where there's less, and actually we should be looking at some other values that we measure when we look at a successful nation.
Yeah.
Is it something you might agree with?
No, absolutely. And I think the aspirations are very different, right? So I think, you know, it's ingrained in us at a very young age that we have to, you know, find a career, make money. You know, our life in a sense is sort of mapped out in a very, very broad way. So certainly in Jersey, you know, you're expected to go to school, you're expected to go to finance, you're expected to get a nice house, you're expected to get married, you're expected to have kids, you're expected to have two holidays a year, and you're expected to retire and just kind of drift away. And that's sort of what a lot of people do. And so you sort of, if you're not doing any of those things, you're considered a bit strange. You know, if you're 40 and you're not married, that's just a bit weird, right? If you're 40 and you haven't got your own house, that's a bit weird. If you're 40 and you haven't got a proper job yet, or you haven't decided what your life's work's going to be, that's seen as pretty odd. And you just don't seem to have any of those kinds of pressures, particularly in the rural areas where I visited. And I think one of the things that they've really got right, if you were to ask me one thing, it's the notion of family. You know, you see people with their families. You have, you know, mother, father, children, grandparents next door in the next hut or just in the same village. People stick together. They help each other. They mobilize. They collaborate. So extended families mean a lot. In this country, and I'm guilty of it, as many people, you know, you grow up and you leave home. In many cases, miles and miles and miles away from your parents. And, you know, when they get old, they sort of many end up in homes because who's going to look after them? And, you know, this is becoming more of an issue now, of course. But that's just a very, very different approach. I think people that I met in Nigeria and Zambia and Uganda and other places I lived and worked, they're kind of generally horrified that we kind of dump our parents.
Yeah. I've seen that as well. I was interested. I was way up in the mountains of Bolivia some years back and visiting with some others, some farming was going on out there, and we're looking at organic farming and fair trade and so on. But up in the mountains, the people were really poor. I mean, yeah, the shoes, they weren't going, the kids didn't have any shoes, they weren't going to school. But the one thing that I took away from it, the people were really happy. They were, I mean, kids running around, and it was fabulous. And I left and talked to the others and saying, you know, we were supposed to be there talking about development, and I'm going, why do we want to, them to experience what we're experiencing, if you like? I mean, but then the other side of the coin is, yeah, but they're living in poverty. Can we just walk away because we think we're happy? So what do we do here? What's the way forward? Leave them alone to be happy, but they don't make 50 years of age in terms of their lifespan? Or do we intervene and maybe make them unhappy?
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a real dilemma. I mean, I would always turn to Indigenous communities when we have this conversation. And if you look at a Indigenous Amazonian community, perhaps one that's never had any outside contact, sure, they don't know how to use the internet and don't know how to read and write English, don't know how to add up in the way that we add up. They may fail every educational measure that we have for our children or for our grown-ups, but they have a very fulfilling life. It's just a different kind of life. And as you say, I think it's very dangerous to say, hey, you know, here in the West, we have the model for development. You all want to be like us because we have figured it out. We have not figured it out. In many cases, we are way behind. And it's obvious we're way behind. And I think, you know, with a slight tech hat on, you know, reading the other week that Facebook were going to be connecting fiber up to Africa to get another couple of billion people onto the internet, I'm thinking, hang on, we know what happens when people get on the internet. We know the fake news. We know the hate speech. We know the challenges to democracy. We know all that bad stuff. Why are we still plowing ahead and insisting that connectivity is everything when it's destroying our way of life, but we're implying that, well, these other people need it because they don't have it? I mean, it just seems to me as just a very, very disconnected way of thinking about the kind of problems that the things that we have caused.
So that's one of the areas we're looking at in terms of a new ism. It's about, you know, our development as a world. Where are we going here? And, you know, a bit about what you're saying is maybe we should go back in time and have a look at some of the values that are precious to us. Is that right? Can we go back in time and forget where we are? Expunge that from our memory and go back in time and say, hey, this is how we're going to progress based on these values that we used to have, you think?
Well, you know, we talk of pivoting all the time, don't we, in the corporate world, and particularly in the social entrepreneurship world or the charity world, that you try something, you realize it's not working, and you pivot, right? You adapt your approach based on your previous learning. I think a lot of what we're seeing is a lack of pivot. We are seeing things going wrong, but we are like a train on a track or an oil tanker. And for some reason, we can't turn. It's behavioral. It's political. It's economic. There's so many vested interests, of course, in all of this as well. And in some cases, I don't think the will is there. And I hate to say that, but I've seen so many large donors and large development organizations who the way things currently are actually suits them very well.
Yeah, because they can control what's going on. So yeah. If you lots of social enterprises and social entrepreneurs will talk about how they really need resource, so they'll bend to whatever the philanthropists want rather than what they possibly think they should be doing in order to get the resource.
Yeah.
And so actually the philanthropic organization is in control in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about how it generally works, not always, but how it generally works, a donor will throw 100 million into a pot and they'll say, here's a challenge around, you know, water, access to water here. And then people will just kind of bid for that money. And so the donor's already set the priority, right? The donor's not saying, okay, everyone out there, here's 100 million. You tell us what the big problems are. You tell us what we should focus on. You tell us how we should spend our money. They basically make that decision, and then everyone scrambles around for that money. And I think a lot of organizations and a lot of people I see working in development, they in many cases don't really believe in what they're doing, or they believe that there is a better way, but because there's no way of doing it that better way, they'll just carry on anyway. And you know, 2 years ago when I stepped back from my 20-odd year career in humanitarian work, and that was largely a factor in that, it was that people were selling themselves short. People would stand up at a conference and say, we should work with local people, we should empower local people, we should give them more responsibility, we should fund more local groups, we shouldn't work in silos, we should collaborate more. All these wonderful things. They'd get 150 retweets and then they go back to the office and they just carry on doing what they were doing before. Ah, you know, like, give me a break. Please stop doing this. At least be honest that you're not doing that. Don't pretend you're doing that and then go. It just drove me nuts. I was just getting very angry.
I think a lot of people are saying that the sector, that charitable sector, NGO sector, actually needs to have a good look at itself. A lot of people saying that now, kind of saying, okay, genuinely, what's our impact? And as you're describing there, some charities, bigger ones in particular, become pretty moribund in terms of, you know, it's right, here's the next annual report we need to get there. The trustees are risk averse, donors are controlling. And it would seem to be that the sector needs to actually change completely in terms of the way it's operating. So you hear much more discussion about, rather than taking money from a donor, we'd like to get into a partnership relationship with a donor, whereby we're working together on, you mentioned water there, on tackling an issue of water, rather than being a recipient of money and having to justify what you're doing. I think that's probably a much better way forward. But the sector is, I think, it's not changing fast enough in terms of the modern world. Therefore, it's just being a recipient of funds which aren't being particularly well used.
Yeah, I mean, if you're really brutal, you could call it what it is, and it's an industry, right? I mean, I remember 6 or 7 years ago writing a blog post about the global health community in North Carolina, of all places, and it was a document from the governors of, or the governor of North Carolina or that area. I don't know how it breaks down. I can't remember. But it said something like global health, it gives us 50,000 jobs and it generates 2 billion for the local economy. I'm thinking, hang on, is global health about fixing health problems in developing countries, or is it a jobs creation scheme for an American state? And it very much was being sold as a job creation scheme for American state. Why aren't those jobs in West Africa, India, Bangladesh, South America? Why isn't that money being spent in those places? I mean, it's almost so in your face, it's embarrassing, but people don't seem to really want to call it out. And I think sometimes if you're too outspoken, you just end up being sidelined by the sector. I mean, a lot of people just don't say what they really want to say.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, my view strongly is that, you know, I work in the area of homelessness, so I would say there is what I call a poverty industry, and you should call it out there. And I say, yeah, I actually work in the poverty industry, but the challenge in the industry, it's not very efficient actually at all. And we should be talking about things like how we put ourselves out of business as organizations. We should be saying, right, the aim is, in my area of homelessness, in 10 years, we're going to end homelessness, then we'll be out of business. So it's not what a lot of organizations are doing, is mimicking the business sector, which is all about growth. So how much did we grow last year? That's not really what this should be about. It's about actually how many people's lives did we impact about whatever it is we were doing. So I agree with you, and I think we should call it out. And I think, you know, if we are, you know, want to work around the sustainable development goals and we want to end extreme poverty, well, it would mean half the charity sector or the poverty industry, you know, shuts down at that time if we achieve that. And that would be, it's not a bad thing. It wouldn't be a bad, sometimes, you know, businesses stop, it's seen as a bad thing, whereas a charity stopping, which doesn't happen very often actually, but if it stops, you could say it's a triumph. We have huge success, we're stopping, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're honest, there are far too many charities. And, you know, probably social entrepreneurship world is perhaps as guilty, that, you know, people's first instinct seems to be, let's create my own startup. Let's create my own foundation. Let's create my own NGO. I remember when I lived in the US listening to NPR, and they would always at the end of every program list off program proudly supported by Joe Bloggs Family Trust. And it would like go on for about 4 minutes. There were so many trusts and so many foundations. I had no idea what any of them were. But I just thought to myself, you know, if some of them are probably doing the same kind of work, and it probably would make sense to perhaps merge a little bit, perhaps, maybe. Yeah. But it just didn't seem to happen. And, you know, to your earlier point about shutting down when you finish the work, I met Eric Stowe from Splash, the water NGO, probably 10 years ago. He had an exit strategy.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind. It was like, oh my goodness, here is somebody who runs a charity and they've got an exit strategy. And I started thinking, you know, what's Oxfam's exit strategy? What's UNICEF's exit strategy? I know these problems are big and they probably will take a long time to solve, and they may never be solved. But just the very notion of putting your hand up and saying, you know, we recognize that there needs to be a time when we stop, was just brilliant. But I haven't seen it since.
Yeah, it's very seldomly around, actually. Of course, that particular charity was, you know, is very successful. It changes the whole culture of the organization, if you think about it. If you have up front there your exit strategy, then you're thinking about that all the time. So it makes it very clear to you, about, you know, on a day-to-day basis what your job is and what you're doing, because there's an exit strategy there.
No, absolutely.
And there's some things that the sector can learn from the business world. Well, listen, I'm very interested in you know, your whole tech side of your work. Because technology, of course, it's made a huge difference to our lives. And a lot of it's been very good, but a lot of it's been not good. You did a lot with the phones and so on in Africa, and have impacted a lot of people. I'm just interested in your take on, you know, how well we're using technology and where this is all going. I mean, is it you know, do we in future years not need to work anymore, and there'll be robots around and technology will be our feet that we'll use, and then we'll have more leisure time to go for walks up hills or whatever. I mean, where are we going with the technology?
I think the biggest trap we've fallen into is you can do anything with technology, right? You can make technology do anything. And in many cases, people do. But few are stopping to think whether they should be doing it before they do it. And I think that's the mess we're in. And so when I was at Sussex, I studied appropriate technology. So E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful, you know, a book from 1973 about building technologies that work for local people, that can be owned for local people, that solve very real problems, that can be adapted by local people. So it's very much an empowerment, local ownership agenda. It was pre the IT kind of digital revolution, but spookily, it still speaks very true to how we are today. Even though the book is 40 odd years ago. I think that there's an obsession with shiny, new, glowing, sexy tech. And the problem we have today is that it's coming out at an increasing frequency. Every couple of months, there's a new phone, there's a new device, there's a new something. Immediately, there's a rush to think about, what can I use this for in Africa? What can I use this for in India? What can I use this for in South America? Without really thinking about the problem first. You know, the answer to a problem could be a blackboard, right? If it's about sharing information at a local post office, rather than having an iPad that people walk up to and press buttons on. And so I think that's how we've got into the mess that we've got into, that we are just too focused on the tech and not enough on the people and the problem. And donors kind of feed that too. They want to have and fund innovative uses of technology. People consider innovative uses of technology as being the latest, the shiniest, the sexiest. AI, drones, smartphones, 4G, 5G, satellites, all that kind of stuff. And the problem with those kind of approaches is local people can rarely own any of that, right? We're not talking about plows or farming implements like in the olden days, or cook stoves, which took up a lot of time for people working appropriate technology in the early days. So that's where I think we've made the mistakes. And that's my reaction to all of that was, when I wrote Frontline SMS, was to try to break that mold. It was to, how do you build something that's really simple, that works in the places where the problem is, that allows the people that own the problem and experience the problem to figure out a way of using that tool, adapting it to their own solution? And how can I almost be invisible? How can I make it not about me, but about what they do with it? And I'm very proud of what we achieved with that, because we did pretty much achieve all of that.
Yeah, I mean, you have a right to be proud. I mean, I love the notion of that, because in Africa, of course, there weren't landlines or a network of landlines. So even poorer people were getting hold of mobile phones, but then couldn't necessarily access whatever on the mobile phones that we could do. But you kind of invented this simple SMS, which of course was so effective and that people could use. And more importantly than using it, I guess, from my point of view, is actually feel included in the world. It's funny, you have this implement in your hand and now you're part of the world, whereas before you were excluded from the world. Did you kind of come across that?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, people, I think, very quickly realized, I was fortunate to be, when I started my mobile tech element of my career in 2003, mobile coverage was starting to expand across the African continent. Mobile phones, cheap, Nokia feature phone type things were starting to get into the hands of some people, not everybody. You know, in those days, lots of people shared phones and you had village phones where people paid to borrow a phone to make a phone call. You have less of that these days because ownership has increased. But back then, businessmen immediately saw the value in being able to drum up work and get work while they were on another job. You know, they'd leave a board up on their wall to say, if I'm not here, call me, text me, I'm on this number. They'll be out doing another job. Whereas previously, they'd have to be sitting on the corner of the road waiting to be picked up for a job, which means they couldn't be doing something else. I think people also realized that rather than walking for half a day to the local post office to queue up to use a landline, which in many cases wasn't working, and then having to trudge back, a mobile phone meant they could do that without having to leave their village. And then, of course, once people realized that you could transfer value and transfer money around using a phone, that completely removed all the dangers and insecurities and issues of carrying money around to pay people for things. So it was revolutionary.
Yeah, but really simple. And I love the way, in some ways, I mean, you touched on it there, and I've heard about this, whereby you could create a micro enterprise around a phone. So some of them were called phone ladies. So they had, the capital for the phone, and then people paid a fraction of a dollar to use the phone for however long. So it was creating a little business. Somebody was getting a job out of just having a phone. That type of application at that micro level where people are very, very poor is in fact very powerful, very impactful.
No, exactly. And that was the Grameen village phone model where, as you say, you'd borrow a small amount of money, usually from a partner microfinance organization. You get a phone, a poster, and a charger and the bits you needed and a SIM card, and you would start a business. And it was mostly women that were drawn to that. I mean, sadly, in most of my experience traveling around rural areas in developing countries, it is the women doing the work. Hate to say that as a man, but, saw lots of very lazy, lazy blokes lying around doing very little and the women doing a lot of the work. And so aiming in at women usually meant that the money was recycled back into the family. It was spent responsibly. And a lot of programs and projects still, of course, focus on women for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, once again, really interesting is that, in the Western world, you've got the kind of allegedly the men are the kind of leaders, but actually in other parts of the world, it's the women who are considered to be the leaders in their own way, but also kind of the people who are safe. And I think probably moving forward, we talk about this newism, what's this new world going to look to? It has to be that there's equality in the world and that women have a clear role in leadership, I would think. Would you agree?
No, absolutely. As we were discussing earlier, I think if I look at the developed world, if we can even call it that, right? I don't really know now what the terms are, right? I refer to what I used to call the developing world, now the global south, because I think that the gap is hard to distinguish. But if I look at many of the countries I admire in the north or the developed world, most are run by women. So I think there's a lot to say for, let's just hand the world over to women for a while and just see if we have this egotistical, crazy, hard man nonsense that we have in so many of our countries right now. I mean, this is a different conversation altogether, but yes, I mean, it's certainly a very different way of doing things between the genders in those kind of instances.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that we looked at this newism, and and other interviews people have talked about is about a bit of a crisis in leadership in the world. So it's almost like the democratic institutions are no longer fit for purpose in the modern world. It's not being anti-democratic. They just didn't catch up. And so what you've got are political parties dominated by men who actually are about power and actually pretty slow to react and aren't really effective leadership. Whereas if you would have different leaders, and you were talking about many more women to be involved, you'd have a different environment altogether. So the leadership system needs to change if we're going to move on in the world.
Yeah, no, completely. And, you know, I think about this quite a lot, having young kids. You know, when I grew up, I was spoiled for choice for moral leadership. Okay, very few of them were in my backyard. But, you know, Mandela, Tutu, people like that who were Dalai Lama, I guess, to an extent, back then too. But, you know, they were people that you could look up to. And they provided moral leadership. I do not know who my kids are going to look up to. Because I don't see anyone.
You think... Again, some people are talking about this at the moment. Do you think social entrepreneurs might fit into that space? That they are seen as authentic people, obviously very kind of in their own silo and in their own space and make an impact in a small way. People now are talking about actually if they were to club together and some of them were to emerge as leaders as a system, you might see some change. So maybe the people your kids might look at might be social entrepreneurs. Is that something you think might happen?
They could be. You know, I mean, I've never really thought about it in those terms. You know, I mean, I admire a lot of social entrepreneurs. I probably admire more people who are not social entrepreneurs. I think we have fallen into a slight trap that by giving some that label and some not that label, that we exclude, you know, some very, very good people. Very moral people doing very, very worthy work from the discussion because they don't have the name. And I actually touch on this at the start of my second book. So I think there's a lot to admire in people. I don't know whether it's the same kind of level of moral leadership though, because I don't know whether social entrepreneurs particularly go out of their way to provide moral leadership. I think they do what they do. And in many cases, do it with a moral, strong moral compass. But you know, I think the moral leaders of the past seem to almost be their job to be a moral leader, right? I mean, you have Desmond Tutu standing in front of tanks, a bit like the Tiananmen Square type incident in South Africa, with just riot police charging all over the place. This little guy just standing there, and just standing up for what he thinks is right, and getting hurt for it. Social entrepreneurs take a lot of bruises, but I don't know how many would stand in front of armed people who were shooting around and well, maybe they all would. I shouldn't speak for them, but I think it's a different kind of scenario.
Yes, it's a different world. I kind of maybe making social entrepreneurs make my question too narrow, but people coming out of civil society, shall we say, and then there are people now, you know, because everybody's got to be labeled these days, as you know. I mean, you've got to have a label. So there's what entrepreneurs these days, and
right.
And so, but I guess the point I'm making is, are there people going to emerge that your kids might look up to from out with the political spectrum? And if so, where are they? Are they people, you know, in the climate change movement, for example? Do they have leaders there that have moral purpose? And that, you know, obviously we should be about protecting our world, our planet for the future. And is that maybe where these type of leaders might come from?
Most likely. I think a lot of it, when you have kids who are the age of my children, you know, two at seven and one at eight, I think the responsibility there is to feed their hunger for information and knowledge, to tell them what's going on in the world, to expose them to injustices, expose them to the good and the bad things that are happening. And they ultimately form their own decision and their judgment. But, you know, Bear Grylls is already something of a hero to them. They've watched a number of Bear Grylls programs. We now have National Geographic on our cable channel, which I could never afford when I was growing up. And they've been watching Bear Grylls' Hostile Planet like crazy, because it shows animals being hunted and species on the line or on the edge of survival. And it fascinates them. And so Bear Grylls has become something of a hero to them because of his work or his documentaries around those issues. So I am pretty sure they will, you know, find their own, you know, leaders. They will find people that inspire them. I will do everything I can to expose them to as many of those kinds of people as possible so that they get the best chance of picking ones that mean something to them. But, you know, David Attenborough, of course, is for many of us is something of a god that we've grown up with. Desmond Tutu was also, you know, for me, and he wrote the foreword to my first book, and that was a very strange moment to have, you know, have that. And, you know, Peter Gabriel and Bill Drayton did the forewords to the second book, and I used to love listening to Peter Gabriel in my young days when I used to drive around Jersey when I was lost trying to figure out what my life was all about. So life does go full circle, but I think my kids will ultimately, yes, they will ultimately find people that they will want to follow and that they will respect and they will admire. And in the meantime, it's my job to expose them to as many of the good and the bad things on the planet without scaring them. You know, don't want my kids to have nightmares, but you know, when they leave half a plate of food, it's never a bad thing to remind them that, you know, lots of children are going to bed hungry, and many in this country.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting you say that, because the way the world's going, because the statistics will show you that actually global poverty, certainly prior to the pandemic, was actually going down, but partly because of what's happening in China and India and almost mini industrial revolutions, if you like, going on there. But the figures are quite large, you know, millions of people. But at the same time, there's a growing gap between the rich and the poor. And I was hearing recently about the number of meals, food that's handed out in the US now. I mean, millions of meals are handed out to people, some of whom will have jobs. It's absolutely astonishing. And this is supposedly the richest country in the world, in terms of how you measure it, but also the Western leading country. And yet here is this country with handing out millions of meals to people. So there's something completely wrong with the system. I would argue that's why we're having these discussions. Is right. What system do you create then in a country like America so that you're not handing out meals? And it was interesting, the person who was talking about this, who was saying at the same time as they were having to hand out all these meals, so they were getting thousands of volunteers to sign up to hand them out. So there was this kind of contradiction of major wealth gap and a crisis almost, but at the same time, the community, the people wanting to help, it's into that kind of little example, if you like, we need to get into and find out what's motivating people to do the right thing and what's causing a system where you have a very wealthy country where people can't afford to get food.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm always reminded of that recent UN report on child poverty in the UK that, you know, highlighted, I think, that by 2025 or something, there'll be 5 million or so young children living in poverty in the UK. That's shocking. You know, I mean, I see my kids sometimes and I feel incredibly bad that, you know, I tuck them up at night and you put the light off and they're all cozy and safe and warm. And I regularly, you know, have major guilt trips that there are so many children out there who don't have that. The fundamentals, fundamental requirements for a happy childhood just aren't there. It's sickening, you know. And of course, the government response is it's a lie, it's not true, rubbish, fake news. I mean, it's. But you know, I think one thing that's that this pandemic I think may well teach us, and it's obviously been very bad, but at the same time, there's been some very positive looking, you know, behavioral changes. That people are now paying attention to their neighbours. People are now talking to people who live in their villages. People are now asking if people are okay, and they're helping people. People are traveling less. They're buying more local. right? These are all things that we knew we should have been doing, and it's taken a pandemic to get us to do them. But maybe we will enter a new compassionate society once this is all over, if we can just make sure we don't let go of all these good habits we've developed. That's the key.
That's the key, isn't it? If there's definitely been a huge upsurge in community spirit, there's no doubt. There's so many examples of it everywhere. But of course, the issue then comes, right, okay, so things return to the way they were before, and so we all get back in our cars and don't have time to acknowledge people in the street because we're too busy. That's the danger. Do you think actually what's happened here has frightened us enough to say, you know what, actually we were going in the wrong direction, and actually this is, you know, it's a good, much better situation that we're in now. We should build something around that.
I mean, I think I don't know many people who don't recognize this as a great opportunity. But, you know, everything is measured, you know, by GDP and growth and jobs. Everything is short term. It's short termism, usually based around the electoral cycle. It's going to be pretty hard to fight that, I think. Most of the people that I know who recognize the opportunity are not in any position to really do very much to change it. I'm not saying they're disenfranchised or lazy or just not willing to do anything. But, you know, in the US, you know, talk of let's not bail out the airlines. It's a dead industry. Let's not bail out the coal industry. But when you have politicians or you have people who have vested commercial private interests in these businesses, that's kind of going to happen. And, you know, I've always maintained that it's far easier to do bad things in the world than it is to do good things. And so even if 99% of us do good things, that 1% of people doing bad things can still drag us back to where we started. It doesn't take many. I mean, Hitler is always the example I use. You know, he's probably had the most impact on the world of any single individual in the last few hundred years.
Yeah, it's
maybe very somebody true. Who's done that, done the similar thing in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
There aren't any.
Yeah. No, you're right. I want to just bring on to a point you're making there, because we're starting to run out of time a little here. Mm. It's a fascinating conversation. It's just in terms of, you mentioned there kind of airlines, you know, not necessarily being saved. I mean, what's the role of business here in terms of, you know, what is a business? What's, you know, you're now involved with kind of social impact side. Are businesses just on earth to just make money, full stop, or do they have a bigger role? And if in the community, and if so, what role is that? And how is that? How do we hold them to account?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I've just finished drafting up a fairly lengthy essay on social purpose. Because at the moment we're seeing a lot of it, right? COVID, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter. Many companies are speaking up. A lot, when you dig a bit deeper, really should probably stay quiet. you know, they have no black members on their boards, perhaps. They have sacked people for supporting, you know, thinking of Kaepernick and the NFL and so on. I think that you know, the days of maximizing shareholder value as being the main driver or the main reason for the existence of a company, that has pretty much long gone. I think also, which is very fortunate, I think CSR as a concept is also, although it seems to dominate online, is also, you know, on the wane. The idea that as a company you could be wreaking havoc on the planet but have a small corporate social responsibility program that does a little bit of good in the corner, which your marketing team shine very bright lights on. I'm thinking here, you know, Extractives, Shell, BP, yeah. Rio Tinto, who recently blew up a 4,000-year-old Aboriginal sacred site to extend an iron ore mine. These companies make all the right noises, but their behavior does not echo that. I think companies now are realizing that consumers want to buy products and services from companies that do genuinely care. They exist for the greater good. They have they have social values that they stick to. We know that young people want to work for these types of organizations. So it is good for business. And we know that capital is easier to access when you are a sound, ethical business. So there's a lot of good reasons to be doing it. And I think more and more businesses now are embracing social purpose. are doing more and more to really better communicate what benefits the world reaps from them existing. And it never used to really be like that. So maybe there's some lessons from social entrepreneurship there kind of bleeding in, but it's happening. And I found it quite fascinating reading up the last few days about, you know, I found 80 examples of companies that have re-engineered their production lines to develop either hand sanitizer or personal protective equipment, and on Black Lives Matter, doing all manner of things to support the movement through donations and appointing, you know, there's now VC setting up entire funds aimed at Black founders and founders of color, I should say. So it's happening. It might not happen fast enough, but it's happening.
I mean, that has to be something positive, but it's interesting, you know, back to almost where we came in this conversation, when we were being a bit critical, both of us, of the charity sector in terms of how productive it was. It's the answer to why in a society some of the issues that you had is business, and it's just business being business, but doing it properly, understanding their role in society, and it's actually business that now has some moral responsibility to make sure that it's doing business in a good world rather than doing business in a bad world.
You know, I couldn't agree more with that statement. And I think the older I've got and the move I've now made back to the private sector 2 and a bit years ago, I'm more convinced than ever that probably the only way we're going to solve some of these problems is through business. And, you know, I wouldn't have said that 20, 10 years ago. My mind has completely shifted. And it's mainly because if a business doesn't produce a product or a service that people are willing to pay for and are drawn towards because of the values it stands for, it goes bust. It disappears. It just goes nowhere, right? The nonprofit sector, it exists by telling stories. It can produce projects. It can have initiatives that nobody wants and nobody attaches any value to. But if it sells a good enough story, it will get money to do more of that. It's a false economy. So I actually feel at this point in my career, in my early 50s, to be back in the private sector where I started in Jersey in my early, you know, mid-teens or whatever it was, late teens, I feel very comfortable where I am now. I feel like it is the best place to be.
That's absolutely fascinating and a very good point just to end, I think, because coming around full circle, but it is one of these kind of questions and issues that keeps emerging is about, take who's responsible for wider community. If business is starting to say it has a role, then actually you potentially have some answers around here. A lot more to discuss in that space, because you're talking about how do you measure that then? How do you prove a company's actually making an impact? And, you know, who's holding them to account? But maybe we leave that for another day, because that's going to be another hour's discussion. But absolutely fascinating to talking to you, Ken. Thanks very much for your time, and enjoy the rest of the lockdown or time with the family.
Enjoy as much as we can. Yeah, thanks, Mel, as well. I really enjoyed the conversation as well. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Ken. Cheers. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to Ken's considered and hopeful opinions on so many themes that are key to the development of the newism. We'll be back next week with another fascinating conversation with a well-known social entrepreneur. If you enjoyed this series, we'd be really grateful if you could rate and review us on iTunes so that our conversations reach as many people as possible. Thank you so much.